content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Steve Lord from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to a half hour of captivating developments in science, medicine, technology, and the world around us, as reported in Discover, the magazine of science. Today's episode from the July-August 2018 issue of Discover features four stories on the Giza Pyramids, personality, the cloud, and octopuses. Everything worth knowing about the Giza Pyramids, Stairways to Heaven. Rising above a desert plateau near Cairo are three giant pyramids. The most famous of them is the Great Pyramid, and together they are the only structure among the seven wonders of the world that is still mostly intact. Extraordinary feats tend to inspire extraordinary explanations. Space aliens! Super-advanced lost civilizations! But the truth is even more interesting. Three Egyptian pharaohs overseeing tens of thousands of workers built the iconic structures at Giza within a 70-year span during the Fourth Dynasty, 2575 through 2465 BC, 4,500 years ago. Recent archaeological discoveries, including the diary of an inspector involved in pyramid construction, explain more about how the pyramids were built and who built them. But many questions remain. Why were they built? The Giza pyramids were tombs for royalty. Scholars say the shape was meant to help the king ascend to the sun god and ensure immortality. The pyramids' angled sides might have been inspired by the spectacle of slanted sunbeams striking the earth. Inspector Marais' Journal. In 2013, Pierre Tallet, an Egyptologist at the University of Paris, Sorbonne, and his team found papyrus scraps stuffed between stones in a building at a Red Sea harbor used during Khufu's reign. It was part of a day-to-day log by an inspector named Marais, who oversaw a cargo boat crew transporting limestone from Tura to the Giza Plateau. Marais refers to the Great Pyramid as the horizon of Khufu, and calls a harbor at the pyramid site Khufu's Pool. Getting there. The pyramid's blocks were cut at Giza quarries and sites along the Nile. They were transported to the construction site in various ways. First, by sledge. The cut blocks were likely placed on sledges and pulled by men or cattle. Water or some other fluid poured on the sand in front of the sledges would have reduced friction. Researchers have simulated the labor many times. It's doable with proper technique and enough muscle. One notable pyramid construction simulation, in 1991, used ancient Egyptian tools and methods to build two sides of an 18-foot pyramid in 21 days. During construction, about a dozen men pulled a rope attached to a sledge loaded with a 2-ton block. "We had no trouble moving these blocks around," says Richard Redding, a research scientist at the Kelsey Museum of Archaeology at the University of Michigan. Second, by boat. White limestone once covered Khufu's and Khafre's pyramids. Some still remain atop Khafre's. When the sun hits this white polished limestone, the reflection would have been seen across the valley, Redding says. The white limestone came from a quarry at Tura on the Nile's east bank, 8 miles away. Granite beams for interior chambers were quarried in Aswan, hundreds of miles south along the Nile. The Tura and Aswan blocks were transported by cargo boat to the Giza Plateau. Before dams were built in modern times, the Nile flooded its banks from August through October. The water would lap up to the pyramid construction site. Sand contour analysis and 72 sediment core samples collected in the late 1980s by a British-American company, indicate that the Egyptians dug canals and harbors on the floodplain to aid passage of cargo boats. They were cutting away the surface of the plateau to create these deep harbors, some deep enough to remain flooded during the low season, says Glenn Dash, a surveyor of the Giza site. Need a lift? How did the Egyptians stack multiple-ton blocks to create a pyramid hundreds of feet high? Scientists and historians have proposed many theories, from elaborate ramps to pulleys tugging blocks up the slanted sides and fulcrums maneuvering them into place. But the exact methods remain unknown. Most researchers agree that the construction involved ramps of some kind, likely made of gypsum, clay, and limestone debris, especially since ramp remnants are still on the plateau. But there's little agreement how the ramps were used in pyramid construction. A straight-on ramp would have to be extremely long to achieve the low grade necessary to transport the blocks, extending far beyond the quarries, an engineering feat in itself. This type of ramp also doesn't solve how the blocks were moved to specific spots on the pyramid. A switchback or wraparound design is the most accepted. The ramp likely was built up from the ground and hugged the pyramid. Workers would pull sledges loaded with stones up the ramp for placement. The ramp rubble was dumped back into the Giza quarries after completing the pyramids. They should have been filled with blown-in sand, Redding says of the quarries, but instead they are filled with rubble. Workers, not slaves. Judeo-Christian tradition characterizes the ancient Egyptians as slaveholders, and the Greek historian Herodotus, who lived about 2,000 years after the completion of the Giza pyramids, wrote that slaves built the pyramids. But recent scholarship offers a different possibility. Conscripted labor. Hieroglyphic inscriptions and graffiti on the monuments suggest that masons, surveyors, and other skilled laborers worked continually at Giza. The grunt work of pulling and lifting the stones was likely performed not by slaves, but by young men from farming villages in the region, Redding says. But it's probable the men didn't have much choice. Ancient Egypt was more or less a feudal system. Nearly everyone owed service, or bak, to citizens higher in the social hierarchy, and that included service to the pharaoh. During the rainy season, when the farming fields were flooded, men were conscripted by the thousands to work on the pyramid projects, says Donald Redford, a professor of classics and ancient Mediterranean studies at Penn State. Cities and cemeteries. Surrounding the Giza pyramids are remnants of worker settlements and cemeteries. The Wall of the Crow, within walking distance of the pyramids, shows evidence of occupation during the Fourth Dynasty, when Khafre and Menkaure ruled, researchers say. Excavation has revealed bone piles of slaughtered animals, suggesting the workers were well-fed. They got better food than what they would get in the villages, says Redding, who did the site's animal analysis. Nearby is a workers' cemetery. The skeletons show medical care for injuries like fractures and no signs of abuse. They took great care of them, Redford adds. Were the unskilled laborers disgruntled? Perhaps not, some researchers say. Being at a location bustling with action and thousands of people for a few months was probably exciting for young men from rustic villages. And because bak was woven into the culture, some say laborers might have felt that, through their work, they were improving their future. By assisting the pharaoh in the afterlife and making sure he could forever stand beside the gods and intercede for you, you were acting in your own interest, Redding says. End of an era. The high point of Egyptian pyramid construction ended around 2510 BC with completion of Menkaure's pyramid, a mini-monument compared with Khufu's and Khafre's. They really couldn't muster the manpower or finances to do it again, Dash says, which is why from that point on, the pyramids got smaller and simpler. Everything worth knowing about personality. Who do you think you are? Your personality is what makes you, well, you, even if experts can't settle on an exact definition of the word. Most agree, however, that personality is the overall pattern of how a person feels, thinks, and behaves throughout life. Theories. Over the years, psychologists studying personality have had no shortage of theories about how it develops and how it affects an individual. Some haven't gotten much traction. Others once had a strong following, but have since fallen out of favor. Take Sigmund Freud, for instance. In the early 1900s, he argued that our unconscious drives who we are. His take inspired others like Alfred Adler and Carl Jung to develop their own views. Although their contributions are important to the field's history, modern personality psychologists tend to focus on other major theories. Here, we'll take you through just some of those, as well as popular tests designed to reveal what makes you tick. The personal construct slash cognitive theory. George Kelly is responsible for this line of thinking, which he published in 1955. He believed the way people act and behave is tied to the subjective ideas they use to interpret the world, their constructs. For example, you'd probably call something a chair if it had four legs, a seat, and a back, because those characteristics fit the chair category in your mind. It was the first theory to emphasize the way a person thinks as the root of personality, which is why many modern psychologists call it the cognitive theory. Although well known today, Kelly's ideas didn't receive much attention when he initially published them. The social cognitive theory. Albert Bandura and Walter Mischel are the heavy hitters of this theory. According to social cognitive subscribers, we develop our personalities through both our thoughts and our interactions with our social environments. Unlike most other frameworks, the social cognitive approach is more interested in how we adjust our behavior in different settings. Phenomenological. Carl Rogers championed this theory in the mid-20th century. Unlike Freud, he believed our subjective conscious experience, our phenomenological experience, and our sense of self were key to personality. Rogers thought our behaviors stem from a need to have our everyday experiences align with how we see ourselves. For example, if you think of yourself as polite, you are likely to behave politely. One major flaw with this theory? There aren't many scientifically viable ways to measure and test these key concepts. The trait-based theory. According to this school of thought, we think, feel, and act consistently, both over time and in different situations. These consistencies are called traits. Today, tests for trait-based theories are relatively easy to use and thus are pretty common. Instead of a single founder, a handful of 20th century scholars made significant contributions: Gordon Allport, Raymond Cattell, and Hans Eysenck. Gordon Allport. Since publishing a first take in the 1920s, Allport continued to refine his theory, which emphasized the importance of the individual rather than subscribing to the idea that everyone fits into a universal set of traits. For instance, Allport favored using an in-depth case study of a person to develop a personality profile, rather than having someone take a standardized test. Although his work has left a lasting impression, he lacked the data to support his theory, and he, like Rogers, didn't develop measurements to test his concept. Raymond Cattell and Hans Eysenck. Cattell, like most other trait theorists, largely believed universal characteristics exist that apply to everyone. After some statistical work in the late 1940s, he defined 16 traits, such as reserved/outgoing, trusting/suspicious, and relaxed/tense. He thought represented the core of personality. Cattell thought these traits were stable overall, but he acknowledged people's moods and social roles also influenced their behavior. Although his theory was more testable than others, 16 variables made for a complicated analysis. Eysenck's traits theory, which he started publishing in 1947, overlaps with Cattell's, but it has a couple of major differences. Most importantly, he simplified things, coming up with just 3 major traits: introversion/extroversion, neuroticism, and psychoticism. Eysenck also believed biology influenced certain traits. For example, he argued that because of differences in the brain, introverts were more mentally stimulated than extroverts, and thus avoided activities like loud parties that would overload them. Overall, while Eysenck's theory was easier to test than Cattell's, many psychologists felt there were traits that didn't fit into Eysenck's framework. And the Big Five, or Ocean Theory. Perhaps the most popular leaf on the personality psychology branch in the Big Five, which evolved out of late 20th century research. Not really attributable to any particular founder, it centers on, as you'd guess, five traits: openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. This theory also goes by Ocean, O-C-E-A-N. Many personality psychologists subscribe to the Big Five because it's the Goldilocks of trait theories, a manageable blend of Cattell's unwieldy 16 traits and Eysenck's mere 3. Tests. Personality tests are more than just a fun way to kill some time online. Sorry, you're which Game of Thrones characters are you? Quiz doesn't count. They can play an important role in anything from identifying candidates who are a good fit for a job to helping therapists figure out treatments for their patients. The Rorschach Inkblot. The Rorschach is the most famous projective test, a group defined by their ambiguity. It's up to the subjects to describe what's presented, revealing their personality through their interpretations. In 1921, Swiss psychiatrist Hermann Rorschach published 10 inkblot cards, developed through trial and error with hospitalized patients. Answers that aligned with the structure of the blots indicated healthy psychological function. Those that didn't revealed abnormal behavior. Role construct repertory. George Kelly, founder of the personal construct / cognitive theory, developed this tool, commonly referred to as the REP test. There are two steps. In the first, you list 20 to 30 people who fulfill specific roles in your life, such as mother or friend. The second part is the crux of the test. The proctor picks 3 people from the list and asks you to describe how 2 of them are similar to each other and different from the third person. Each trio is supposed to reveal a construct you've built, and thus, according to Kelly's theory, how you think about the world. Thanks to its open-ended nature, the REP test reveals twice as much information as the Big Five questionnaire. The Big Five questionnaire. This is one of the most popular and straightforward of the trait tests. You simply rate how you usually act, rather than how you think you might act in the future, or how you wish you would act. The Thematic Apperception Test, or TAT. This is another projective test. TAT consists of a series of cards with a variety of scenes on them. This point, similar to the Rorschach test, is to interpret the scenes and describe what you think is happening. The test is based on the idea, according to co-creator Henry Murray, that when a person interprets an ambiguous social situation, that person's personality is exposed. Everything worth knowing about the cloud, clearing the fog from our digital future. Billions of people use the internet every day, from posting Facebook photos to checking their bank accounts. Much of that happens in the cloud, but what is it really? 3 layers of the cloud. Software as a service, SaaS. You interact with this one the most. SaaS lets users pay cloud providers to completely handle the back-end part of their apps. Any public website that can also be an app falls under SaaS, like Google Docs, Gmail, and Microsoft 365. Infrastructure as a Service, IaaS. This allows businesses to rent the equipment necessary to support the cloud. Companies maintain control over their software, but leave the equipment, storage, and maintenance to IaaS providers like Amazon Web Services, Microsoft Azure, Google Cloud, and Alibaba. Platform as a Service, PaaS. Geared toward software developers, PaaS providers offer a remote platform, free from a company's own computers, to quickly build the cloud services and apps we all enjoy. Engine Yard is one example. Origins of the cloud. Cloud computing didn't come from a single event or person. Several computer scientists in the 1950s and 60s laid out its basic concepts. But it was the rise of accessible high-speed internet in the 2000s and the drive for efficiency that ushered in the cloud era. But it was the rise of accessible high-speed internet in the 2000s and the drive for efficiency that ushered in the cloud era. As for the name itself, some report Google and Amazon using the term cloud computing in 2006, while MIT Technology Review discovered a 1996 Compaq business plan, including that phrase. Universal access. Many believe the cloud is the internet, but it's really nothing more than a connection mechanism, says David Linthicum, a cloud expert and chief cloud strategy officer at Deloitte Consulting. Among information technology circles, the cloud is simply shorthand for someone else's computer. You can manage and store your content, music, photos, data, from anywhere, using the internet to access servers in vast data centers, literally other people's computers. Gone are the days of buying expensive software and worrying about having enough space on your device. Rely on Uber for rides? Love scrolling through your grandkids' Facebook pics? Without the cloud, such apps couldn't exist. Those don't exist on your phone. They exist in some data center, says Linthicum. That's the beauty of the cloud, because you don't even know that it's there. Best of all, you don't have to understand it to use it. You can leave that to service providers like Amazon, Google, IBM, and Intel, which have invested heavily in cloud computing for both individuals and companies. Data centers. All over the world, data centers, some big enough to cover 10 football fields, house thousands upon thousands of computers called servers that act as the middlemen. When you click on a Facebook post, they process your request and serve up the content. Fast fact. Running these cloud-powering centers requires a lot of energy. The U.S. is home to over 3 million data centers, using enough energy to power 6.5 million homes, almost 2% of total U.S. energy consumption. Security. Storing data in the cloud means relinquishing control to other people's computers, and that's scary. But the cloud is safer than you think. Public providers like Google and Linux employ hundreds of people just to maintain and secure the cloud. So your data often is more secure in the cloud than in the hands of smaller companies that keep their data on site. That's not to say the cloud can't be hacked. Serious vulnerabilities called Spectre and Meltdown made headlines earlier in 2018 because they affect virtually all computers, including servers. Many cloud providers automatically turn your information into code, called encryption, before the data hits their servers. If they don't, you can find third-party tools online that'll do the trick. And as a standard rule of thumb, always create strong passwords to avoid getting hacked. Security is only as good as the brain power of the people who own the accounts, Linthicum says. Everything worth knowing about octopuses. These boneless brainiacs play by their own rules. A Hawaiian creation myth suggests that our world emerged from the ruins of another. Everything we see was formed anew, but for one survivor from a previous age, the octopus. Technically mollusks with large brains that are organized in a distinctly different way from ours, octopuses may be the planet's smartest invertebrates. Many-limbed, totally boneless, and with skin color and texture that can change in a heartbeat, octopuses seem downright otherworldly. To meet one is to come as close as we can get to an intelligent alien. Armed with 8 facts. Self-editing. Octopuses can make significant changes to their RNA, the messengers that ferry instructions from DNA to cells. This ability helps them adapt to the cold, and may even play a role in why they're so clever. Octopia. In 2017, researchers reported that members of one octopus species lived in close proximity to each other, the first time such behavior has been documented among the famously solitary creatures. The octopuses apparently gathered to exploit ample food resources, scallops. So numerous were the emptied and discarded scallop shells that they could be mistaken for mini cities on the ocean floor. But it was no utopia. Evictions by larger octopuses were common. Tasty. Octopus arms are muscular and boneless. The best human analog would be the tongue, and the comparison is especially apt. The hundreds of suckers that line each of the arms are covered in chemoreceptors, similar to our own taste buds. Octopuses can taste everything they touch. The ability is likely what allows them to recognize their own arms and prevent them from getting stuck together. It takes brains not to tangle. Octopus arms are filled with neurons. In fact, more brain cells reside in their eight arms than in their entire brain. Their bodies are so complex, argues one researcher, that they need significant brain power just to control their endlessly malleable limbs. Hide in plain sight. An octopus can become a strand of seaweed, or a rock pile, or melt seamlessly into the sand within seconds. They are masters of disguise, thanks to sacks of pigment in their skin controlled by muscles, as well as cells that reflect and scatter light. Squishiness. Being boneless has its advantages. Because they can rearrange their bodies into almost any shape, large octopuses have been known to squeeze through openings of just a few inches. Any space larger than their beak, one of the only hard parts of an octopus, is fair game. Humble beginnings. The last common ancestor we shared with octopuses lived over 500 million years ago, and probably looked something like a worm. Although octopus fossils are rare, because the animals lack bones, their lineage goes back at least 300 million years, meaning they predate dinosaurs. Ranging far and wide. Octopuses have adapted to a broad range of ocean environments, from coral reefs to the deep sea, and from equatorial waters to Antarctica and the Gulf of Alaska. And finally, not as easy as pie. One octopus, two octopi? That spelling is actually incorrect, because it's based on Latin grammar. The word octopus is derived from ancient Greek, so the proper plural is octopodes. If that's a bit too formal, octopuses is also acceptable. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover, the magazine of science. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. Till then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.